Introduction. My name is Michele Petocchi, and I am the forum leader for university relations. And I'm pretty proud of introducing actually three friends today. Two are juridical friends. The first friend is the University of Oxford, with which the forum has a great and progressing relationship among the top universities we work with. The second juridical person is the School of 21st Century at the University of Oxford, which is at the, it's a school at the forefront of the systemic and topic-specific analysis of risks and challenges that the future holds for us. And actually, the physical friend I'm really happy to introduce to you today is Dr. Jan Goldin, who is the director of the 21st Century School at Oxford University. Jan came to Davos, I was looking at the database, first time in 1997 at the Winter Davos, and he's been one of the most engaged, active, and proactive collaborators and leaders on the forum platform. So I leave it to you to tell us what the forum holds.
Thank you, Michele. Let's get... So one thing we know about the future is that it is very uncertain. The best minds with the greatest institutions get their thinking about the future wrong. This is in technology, where the leaders of great institutions are celebrated to get it wrong. It is in the areas of politics, where MI5, MI6, the great intelligence agencies and leaders of the world habitually get things wrong, as they famously did only 3 years before Mandela was released. And of course, more recently, we've seen this political failure of future thinking in the US, where Obama, a year before he became elected, was unimaginable as a leader. And we certainly see this in finance, where we have the most comprehensive system of thinking about the future. We have institutions like the IMF, like the Financial Stability Forum, which were established with the task of understanding and managing global risks. And yet the 20,000 economists employed with that job in mind weren't able to see this coming. So I want to begin my talk about the future by emphasizing how uncertain it is and how important it is not to predict, but to think systemically, to think of structural change, to think of the big things that are happening, but don't try and predict, because only by luck will you be right. Now, the most fundamental force that's driving this, and which is informing the reason why it's getting more and more difficult to predict, is globalization. Globalization is a wonderful thing. It has brought immense benefits, but we need to appreciate the pace at which it is changing. Note that this is a logarithmic scale of growth of income as population have grown. And so we've had this remarkable experience in the last 40 years, which was only an experience of about 1,000 years ago, when income has exceeded population growth. And remarkably, this period of about 1,000 years ago was a period when societies came together, where Islamic and Christian and Judeo societies met, and when East met West, when China and Europe and India came together, and there was a spasm of innovation. But that was short-lived. And we've been through such an experience again since about 1980s. The fall of the Berlin Wall, the opening up of China have been a major part of this, but so too have policy changes around the world, including in the areas of macroeconomics and in many other areas. And you see this in the financial flows. This is 1990, this is financial flows to developing countries. About 1990, a structural change, great instability, but very different levels of flows. And associated with these flows are, of course, the flows of ideas that go with the internet, which go with innovation. And it's this innovation, this coming together of people with finance across the world that has led to an explosion of globalization and potential that comes from our creativity around the world. So it's a most exciting and wonderful period in the history of humanity. It's a period which, if you stand back and look at the Earth over a long view, must be the best period ever to be living. Life expectancy at birth of our generation has increased by over 20 years. It took from the Stone Age to our generation's birth to achieve that. The number of poor people living under a dollar a day has gone down dramatically, despite the world's population increasing by about 2 billion over this time. And the number of illiterate people on Earth has gone down by about a half over this period. And you can look at any different index you wish, and on virtually any of them, except the ones related to the environment, which I will come back to, there's been this leap in improvement. So we live in a golden age. And the key question is, will this continue? Will the 21st century be the period in which we finally eradicate poverty and disease? Will it be the period of eco-affluence, as we may like to think about, or will it be a period of disaster? And this is the key question we face. Now, looking at the future, as I indicated, is unpredictable. And these are simply the UN population projections going out to 2050. We are here at just under 7 billion. And what you see in this is this range of uncertainty. A range of uncertainty of almost 4 billion people looking out only 40 years. That's two-thirds of the population of the planet of uncertainty, with enormous consequences for virtually anything we think of course, economic growth and the environment being amongst them. And why is there such uncertainty? There's uncertainty because we don't understand some of the key drivers, particularly of fertility, but also of longevity. And this, if one breaks it down by region, one finds similar sorts of trends, with some regions growing down very quickly. And I personally am rather, if you want to call it that, optimistic on this front. I think we'll be at the lower end of the projections for the reasons you'll see in a minute. Now, we're very fortunate in Oxford to have an Institute of Aging as part of the 21st Century School, and Professor Sarah Harper in the back is the leader of this institute, which is doing a lot of work on the key drivers of longevity and fertility. And what you see in this is a continual improvement and a convergence in longevity over this period, so that we are increasing our life expectations by at least 2 years every decade. And the great news about coming to Dalian, apart from its many other merits, is that I think your life expectancy while here will increase by, what, about 90 minutes, I imagine, over these days. So this is the tremendous progress that's happening in the world through technology and through public health and other means. Of course, we won't say that if you'd stayed at home and slept or gone to the beach, your life expectancy would have similarly increased. Your mental capacity has leaped forward as well, which is a tremendous achievement. I think these might also be rather conventional numbers for the reasons we'll see in terms of the miracles in medicine. But these are more stable projections and converging projections than the fertility projections, where you see a dramatic shift in a very, very short period of time. In one generation, fertility declining dramatically, and converging below 2 in every part of the world except Africa, and in some parts of this region, as we know, much closer to 1, including in parts of China, much closer to 1, with dramatic consequences for global growth, and not least the fiscal and pensions dependency ratios in public and private groupings, and we'll come back to those in a minute. But this is a convergence, and a dramatic one, in a very, very, very short space of time on the fertility side, which is likely to continue. And so we get into the question of what aging in the future, and what we see in this graph is the rapid decline in the youth, from about 1980, the rapid increase in the over 60s, and the number of elderly overtaking the number of young in about 20 to 40 years' time, more like 30 years' time. And this, of course, is something which has dramatic implications around the world. This is Italy, and you see over 2030 how we move from a population pyramid and the conventional understanding of demographic structures to what some may call a coffin shape. And you wouldn't want to be these people paying for those people, but equally you wouldn't want to be these people getting up there worrying about who's going to push you around in your wheelchairs and who is going to pay for your health systems. And this, of course, is a global story. So dramatic changes demographically around the world. And similarly in China, this goes out to 2050, you see the potential for massive change, moving to a skyscraper, or how my aesthetic colleague Sarah calls it, a vase. But this is a healthier structure. Note some of the imbalances on gender going forward. Provinces in China with very significant gender imbalances playing through, and of course the dependency ratios increase for this. So we will very soon be moving to a situation where already we have, the most people in the world aged will be in in Asia, and what you see is about 700 million elderly people in Asia. Other regions, of course, also rapid growth, but Asia having more elderly than the rest of the world put together. Very, very dramatic story of demographic change with many social consequences that go for it. One of the questions is, can migration compensate for the elderly? Will we have the migrants to not only enter our workforces, to pay our pensions, to push us around when we're very elderly? And I think the answer is no. This is the rich countries' labor forces. You see a decline in the number of workers from about 800 million to about 600 million over this period. And even very major increases in the number of migrants of the scale of about 100 million people wouldn't compensate for this decline in migrants. This is really, in many political terms, difficult to think of. But still, migration has to be a very, very significant part of the story of how one meets these imbalances in the future. Of course, the question will also be, where do the migrants come from? Because the donor countries will be running down their demographics and going through the demographic shift even more quickly than the rich countries by then. So it's not obvious that people want to migrate from the countries that currently they migrate from. The key question in this region is, will the boom continue? What can we expect of this region? It's been a region, of course, of the most remarkable change in history. Never before in human history has any part of the world ever grown in this sort of way over a sustained period of time. So this is a totally new human experience, the transformation that's happening here, and one that brings great excitement, but also, of course, many, many other different dimensions. This is work we did at the World Bank just before I left it, and its projections out to 2030 of economic trends, and you see that this was done before the crisis, although I don't think the fundamentals have changed in any significant way around us, and it projects continued average growth rates of around 7% for China, Asia, still leading, and very tepid, slow growth rates in the rest of the world. So the developing world growing much more rapidly, continually so, over into the future, and the rich countries continued slow growth with an optimistic outlook for China over the long term, and happy to come back in discussions for the reasons for this. Now, what does this mean when you run the statistics through? What it means is that China very rapidly becomes the biggest economy in the world in GDP terms. This is the historicals. This is China in red along here, already overtaking everyone except the US the European Union. But that quickly changes. When you go to this, this is a continuation of the US line, and depending on the projections that you cast for China, it overtakes the US in somewhere between 2030 and 2050. And again on this, I'm an optimist for China, and I think it's likely to be closer to 2030. So it becomes the powerhouse with all sorts of implications that we can discuss in other areas. When you look at the implications for global shares of GDP, you see the rapid transformation. And this is a share of global product, China moving from around 4% to well over a quarter of global product over this period, and the others commensurately declining because of that. Now, stepping away from economics to think of some of the technological revolutions that are going to drive the future, this is a period of the most remarkable growth, and some have said exponential growth, though I don't like that term, in technologies. And that has a huge upside potential. It's the reason why globalization has moved so rapidly. Containerization, fiber optics, air transport, and all the other tools. But it is also the reason why we are so fragile. And so I'd like to look at a number of these and just give a sense of what's driving in the future. Behind a lot of what we see in technology is this story. It's Moore's Law. The ability of computers to increase their capacity by cost about at a double every 18 months. And this has been a rather stable trend over a long period of time since Moore in the 60s figured it out. But he thought it would run out after two generations. The remarkable thing is that when you speak to the people working in this area, they don't see a limit to the ability of computing power by price to double about every 18 months, because as we begin to run out of our etching capacity on silicon, we move to quantum and other computing. Now, what does this mean? This means that for the same price, you can do the most remarkable things, so that my mobile phone is more powerful than the entire Apollo computing system in the 60s. My son's PlayStation 3 is more powerful than the Deep Blue computer which beat and challenged Kasparov 11 years ago. So that is what happens when you get this exponential growth and you run it through everything with the most amazing potential. So for $1,000 we're about at lizard power now, they say, and we should be at brain capacity in 20 to 40 years' time. That is the most speculative of the statements that I will make today, because I actually don't believe it either, because we don't understand the brain. But the capacity is doubling by price in this period. And this permeates everything and is the opportunity for everything that we do in technological change. One of the things it does, of course, is this most remarkable story on the internet and web. This is, again, a logarithmic scale here, billions of gigabytes. The amount of storage, that's what we can have in our brains, about 100 million, and then, sorry, 10 million, and then what is happening every year. And this is the most remarkable story. So every month now, we are able to reproduce the entire amount of information ever created by mankind in documentation. And this is moving to every day in a couple of years' time. So this is the power of the chip with the information absorption. And the good news is that the storage capacity, our ability to manage this, is growing even more rapidly. That's that line at the top, and you'll know that from going out to buy what used to be a few K of memory stick and is now a few gig for the same price. And so this is the story which allows us to transfer and to innovate. It's also the reason why societies that are grabbing hold of it, like China, will become the leaders, and why China's opening up to the world is so influenced by this. Part of the story is also a story of miniaturization, and I'm glad to have here today also Professor John Ryan, who leads our nanomedicine group in the 21st Century School. This is not a photograph, this is a mock-up, because nanomachines don't look like Meccano sets, but it's a sense of scale with a dust mite. These are billionth of a meter size manipulations, and this is, again, a mock-up simulation of a nano needle going through a cell from John's unit, trying to understand what happens when we get into nanomedicine and go through a cell. And as John will explain, I feel this doesn't look very healthy in terms of what it takes through the cell. Now, of course, nano is already being used. In the UK, you can buy sunscreen off the local pharmacy shops with nano in, and so on. There's not much of a regulatory and other environment around this. And so part of what we need to understand is what is the health and other implications of these new technologies. And just as in derivatives, we discovered that the machines were giving us time bombs, or some have said weapons of mass destruction, so too may be the case with other technologies. Our ability to understand them is limited. Another very powerful development of the 21st century will be stem cells. And I'm also delighted to have Dr. Paul Fairchild here, who's the director of our Stem Cell Institute. This is a photograph of a cardiac stem cell filmed in Oxford from an embryonic cell. The cells which can be made to become any part of the body, directors. And the revolutions that this will create in terms of the potential for regenerative medicine are beyond our imagination. The sorts of things that allow, as Paul said this morning, a salamander to recreate parts of their body might be things that we can envisage even within our lifetimes. And the ability to direct this towards all forms of regenerative medicine will make it very difficult to think about what we think about now in terms of therapeutic medicine for paraplegic and many other ailments. Even more difficult to get our heads around is what's happening in some of the genetic work. This is a film of two mice. The back one is a wild mouse. The front one is one that's been genetically manipulated to become much more effective. It consumes a little bit more food, but it can run for six times the time of the other mouse. And it can just keep running and keep running for 6 hours like this. Now you begin to imagine What happens when we start genetic manipulation of human beings? It raises enormous questions regarding ethics, regarding equity, and of course regarding access. What it is to be human goes to the very core of this question. But the technologies are developing which allow a transformation, for the first time in our history, of our very being. We are affected by our upbringings, by our environment, by our nutrition, by our schooling, and many other things to have different outcomes. But we believe in a concept of broad equality of humans in their essence. What this allows is thinking about people that are actually hardwired to be superior in some ways, and raises many, many deep questions about the future of humanity, about regulation, about competition between companies, countries, and many other areas. And it's an issue we are focusing very deeply on in our Institute on Bioethics, which brings together bioethicists with medics and biochemists and others. That is one big risk and issue facing us. It's one that's not got much attention, but which is extremely important at the global level. There are the traditional risks, which you know about, the pandemic and other risks, which will also affect us in a very deep way. There are things we will do to ourselves, the anthropogenic, and things which nature will do to us. I don't worry about these ones, an asteroid hitting us, whatever. That is a very small risk, and there's not much we can do about it. These are the ones that are growing very, very rapidly, because our potential to destroy ourselves is much greater than before. So the things we worry about are not what I used to worry about before I joined the 21st century school, or things like this. Now I worry up there. And this is issues that can affect the very future of civilization. Humanity might survive as a species, but everything we've achieved and this great achievement of globalization is threatened in this process. Now, Lord Martin Rees, who's the president of the Royal Society in England, I think one of the wisest and smartest men in Britain, puts a 50% probability in his book, Our Final Century, on civilization not surviving the 21st century. Let's say he's pessimistic, and it's 5%. It is still extremely important to worry and think about these issues. And the point is that this risk is growing, whatever it is, because of our interdependence, our integration, and our technological capacity, partly liberated by the internet and the communication. This integration and interdependence has led to a systemic risk, which leads to tipping points. Now, one of these graphs is the Great Crash, and the other is water boiling, and you difficult to label them because they have similar characteristics. We don't understand them until they've happened and they change. The risks move very rapidly. This is from the World Economic Forum risk reports. And whichever way we look at it, we are unable to predict them. The point is that the long tail is wagging much more aggressively. These very low probability, very high impact events are a cause of increasing concern. Because if there's one of them in one place, it shakes the whole system. And that's what we've seen in the financial crisis, which is the first systemic risk of the 21st century. It had the characteristics of being a result of very rapid globalization, very rapid technological change, and an evolution of ideas which leapfrog way ahead of institutions. And so the institutions that were set up only 10 years ago, the Financial Stability Forum and the IMF, which was set up in an earlier period, to manage global risk, didn't even see this thing coming, let alone have an ability to deal with it. So how do we begin to think of these, and which are the principal ones? Climate change is obviously one that we've heard a lot about, and it's extremely important. I think it will, unfortunately, be a dramatic systemic shock for the system. It will be like a tsunami shock. It comes slowly, and then suddenly one sees its effect in a very broad way, a surprising effect, unpredictable. And the scientists know what the average numbers are, and these are the average IPCC projections of temperature change. But there's very little understanding of detail, of tipping points, and of the impact on any one society. Of course, the poor and the vulnerable, particularly in Africa, in Asia, are the ones that suffer most from these shocks. And they are the ones that stand the much to lose. China's in a difficult position here. China has a relatively low per capita emission, around 2 tons per capita. It's not up with some of the other developing countries that you can see there, but it's growing extremely rapidly, and because of its numbers, small per capita numbers aggregate to very, very high total numbers, so that it's rapidly becoming the largest carbon emitter on Earth, if it's not already. So it has a dramatically important role to play, and we should discuss some of the things that can be done. Pandemics is another systemic shock. Pandemics will affect us most. Pandemics have always been the biggest killers of humanity. For some reason, we are myopic. And the rather benign, touch wood, results so far of the current pandemic should not give us false hope. This is a lurking and continual threat, and the more integrated we are, the bigger it is. Of course, the really worrying dimension is not so much only natural, but also man-made. Now, the sorts of things we can do, and this is from our Institute on Emergent Infections and Pandemics in the 21st Century Group, is trying to understand how we should respond to a pandemic. What should we do? How do you intervene? And this is an extremely important preventive coordination issue. Bioterrorism, which is the ability of individuals to create a pandemic through DNA synthesizers, through other means, as we've seen a hint of in the anthrax scare, is perhaps the most worrying, because a single individual or group of individuals could create absolute havoc in very large parts of the world. So how we detect these things at source, how we isolate them and control them, is a key global priority. I mentioned the bioethical issues associated with bioengineering, with all the other dimensions of the medical miracles, stem cell research, cloning, concentration enhancement, chemicals. There's no part of our body that will be improved. And we will be able to enhance the mind as well. This is interesting data from looking at people that were near highways suffering from lead in the air. And what happens when you increase the IQ, a very crude measure of ability, by a small percentage? And the effects in a whole range of areas, including GDP, social behavior, and so on. And what you see is that particularly at the lower end of the spectrum, small changes can lead to very dramatic social incomes. Now, this is very deeply difficult in terms of ethics and in equity and many other areas. But if we do have the ability to increase concentration, to increase intelligence, to increase IQ, if you want, should we use it? And if we don't use it in our companies or in our society, and a competitor does, what will we do? Should there be national regulation? Should there be global regulation around these issues? These are the conversations that corporate and global leaders will be having in Davos's and Dalian's of the future. Very difficult questions about distribution. Also, access to these will be absolutely key. Will these wonderful medical miracles be available on national health services in Africa, or even poor European countries, let alone China, and, of course, the others? Or will it just be that the richest countries become a superhuman race because their people can afford the drugs and the enhancement that others cannot? Very difficult questions. And equality, of course, a driving risk of society, already with this fantastic improvement of globalization, very rapidly widening inequality around the world, which will increase further in the years to come, leading to instability. These lead systemic risks. The integration of these different risks are what concern us. The importance of understanding how one piece connects with the other. It is an extraordinarily complex set of changes that are happening. Enormous potential to bring about a world which our parents could not have dreamed of. But there's also the most extraordinary risk that's associated with. The underbelly of globalization is fragility. It's that we are more vulnerable than ever before. The upside is that we are more powerful as individuals and as countries to change our lives than ever before. We have to ask ourselves, who's going to make the decisions? Who is going to be having their hands on the steering wheel as we navigate this very complex territory? And to what extent can we trust the institutions which manage the world? Are these institutions, many of which are post-Second World War, which emerged in response to previous crises, the ones that we would trust to deal with the future? And if not, how can we either transform them or create new ones, new systems that will lead to a good outcome. I believe this is the most important question. How do we evolve a global management system to meet the 21st century challenges? It's one that's absolutely central to the answer, will this century be our best century? Will we have the wisdom to conquer our fears, our anxieties, to collectively bring a better outcome? Or will it be our worst? The future, I believe, is in our hands, and it really is up to us to put our best minds together to come to a solution which we all can live with happiness. Thank you.